Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen, and Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is August 28, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us for a discussion on Hitler's speech from the 12th September 1938 on the situation in Czechoslovakia. How are you tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And, excuse me, and in our last few speeches, we've covered the situation in Poland, the situation just before Germany began the campaign against France, and in all of these instances, Germany continually made overtures for peace. They wanted to avoid military confrontation because Hitler didn't want another bloody war that would cause millions of deaths in Europe. He wanted to avoid that at all costs, but the Allied powers, being run and dominated by Jews, they wanted a mega war. They wanted war no matter what.
Well, without a doubt, the Jews wanted war against Hitler. The Jews knew that Hitler didn't want war. And there are quotes to that effect, and maybe we'll just cover that one for one program one day soon. But they absolutely knew that Hitler didn't want war, and Hitler in his own speeches said time and time again, he warned about the international Jew plunging Europe into another great war. And he warned about it for several years before it actually happened. And they used Poland to agitate that war and make Adolf Hitler and Germany look bad. And make them look like the aggressor. They concealed from the West what was actually happening in Poland. I mean, the leaders knew, but the general public didn't have a clue. They had no idea what was going on in Poland. So when the media blamed Germany as being the aggressor, that's the way history was written, and the general public believed it.
And in fact, in the U.S., in 1936, General Wood testified before a Senate committee that Churchill told him Germany was getting too strong again and should be destroyed in a new war and crushed.
Well, there's a quote that's extant that's supposed to be from Churchill. I have to research it. After World War I, where he bragged that Germany would never be a strong nation again, right? After World War I, Churchill was the equivalent of our Secretary of the Navy in Britain, right? He was the Parliament member, Lord Admiralty. No, I don't think he was Lord Naval Minister or whatever our equivalent is to Naval Secretary.
For the Admiralty, he was right.
Was he Lord of the Admiralty? I don't know, but I thought he was in Parliament. Well, anyway, he was the equivalent of our Secretary of the Navy during World One, which is and Franklin D. Roosevelt was our Secretary of the Navy. And they both went on to become the leaders of the political leaders of their nations during World War II. That can't be a coincidence. I'll never believe that.
It's certainly interesting, to say the least.
Well, Czechoslovakia. Well, the first president of the Czech, the artificially constructed nation of Czechoslovakia, I can't even say it right, I'm sorry, was a professor. His name was T.G. Masaryk, and he was actually a Mason. He was a Grand Orient Lodge member, right? And one of his foreign minister was a Dr. Edouard Benes, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, B-E-N-E-S. And Benes was also a prominent figure in Masonry. And I have here an article that we should probably want to cover next week, and we should probably talk about the expulsion and the abuse and practical genocide of Germans in Czechoslovakia after the war. right? But Czechoslovakia was an artificially created nation after World War One. It was the Czech Republic today occupies the ancient districts of Bohemia and Moravia, and Slovakia was actually carved out of much of what used to be Northern Hungary, and it was this multi-ethnic nation consisting of Germans, Czechs, Slovaks, Poles, Hungarians, and Gypsies, and Jews, what was absolutely contrary to Woodrow Wilson's 14 points, right, that said that each people had a right to self-determination, that this multi-ethnic nation carved out of land stolen from other nations, for the most part, what was actually put under one government, and it was never really a nation. It couldn't last. It even today there are problems there. In Slovakia, for instance, we have about 5 million people today, and probably 20% of them aren't Slovaks, at least. I know at least 10% of them are ethnic Hungarians. So there were 3.5 million Germans living in lands after World War One that became ruled over by the Slavs and the Czechs, right? Ruled over by this artificial nation, Czechoslovakia. And these people had a very difficult time. I'm going to read one paragraph from this article by Dan Michaels. It's a 2001 Barnes Review article, and it's entitled Edward Benes, the Bohemian Pawn. And he's talking about the history of Czechoslovakia under Edward Benes. Where Benes actually, after he drove all the Germans out of Czechoslovakia after World War II, which he did, and I think it was close to 8 million Germans who were displaced, and I'd have to go from memory, but at least a million of them are, and I've heard that number is a low number, I believe, were reportedly killed in the expulsion of Germans from Czechoslovakia after the war. Well, he then basically handed Czechoslovakia over to Stalin after the war. He basically surrendered the nation to the Soviets, and it became a Soviet state.
Oh, and I wanted to point out, too, that I believe a French general remarked in the early 30s or maybe late 20s that Czechoslovakia was created explicitly to give France an air base by which they would be able to attack all the cities and industrial centers of central and eastern Germany in the event that war broke out again, so that France would have a ready-made air base in the form of Czechoslovakia to terrorize Germany's cities in central and eastern Germany.
Well, in this article, Michaels actually attributes the creation of Czechoslovakia to France. That they were the biggest advocates of creating this artificial nation, so that very well may be. And we should probably talk about that in more depth next week. Well, Benes, when he first rose to power in Czechoslovakia, after Masaryk had left office, Michaels portrays Benes as having an attitude where Czechoslovakia should be governed in a form modeled after the Swiss Republic, which is also a multi-ethnic nation, but which, you know, French speakers, German speakers, Italian speakers, but which
grants autonomy,
which is a lot more racially homogenous than anyway, because most of those people are from the same origins, right? Well, the Swiss Republic, even though you have four languages there, I think they get along very well with each other, right? And they've had relative peace and prosperity for many years. In 1937, Benes had modified his policy, according to Michaels, and Benes is quoted as having said that when we say Switzerland will be a model for Czechoslovakia, this does not mean the creation of a new Switzerland with identical institutions, but precisely to the contrary, the creation of a state with institutions which take into account the special situation in Bohemia. And Michaels goes on to describe that by this time, Benes's policy of installing Czechs who were basically urban, Protestant, and industrialized, and liberal bohemians, right? In key governmental positions was well advanced, and this is 1937, right? And the Slovaks, who were basically Catholic and agrarian and conservative, along with the Germans, Poles, and Hungarians, were being gradually disenfranchised and discriminated against. Viscount Walter Runciman, a confidant of Prime Minister Chamberlain, in a report to the Prime Minister on the situation in late 1938, said, "It is a hard thing to be ruled by an alien race." And he's talking about the Sudeten Germans and the Czech rule. Czechoslovak rule in the Sudeten areas for the last 20 years has been marked by tactlessness, lack of understanding, petty intolerance, and discrimination to the point where the resentment of the German population is inevitably moving in the direction of revolt. Czech officials and Czech police, speaking little or no German, were appointed in large numbers to purely German districts. Czech firms are favored against German firms in the allocation of state contracts, and the state provides work for relief and relief for the Czechs more readily than for the Germans. So the Germans were being oppressed, and that's
like
probably the report seems to be putting it mildly.
Sounds like how white people in general are treated in this country.
Well, right, now we are. By the time of the Munich Pact in 1938, and I know you want to talk about that, all parties involved in Caesarian birth of Czechoslovakia, including Benedict himself, agreed that the Sudeten Germans were entitled to live under German rule. Well, that's Wilson's 14 points in the first place, right, which were just ignored. Under the wise leadership of Neville Chamberlain, Britain was beginning to rectify some of the totally unjust provisions of Versailles. And Chamberlain had always recognized Versailles as being unjust. Saint-Germain and Trianon. Saint-Germain was basically Austria's Versailles, right? And the Treaty of Trianon was the treaty that split Hungary up and gave 72% of its territory. 72% of the ancient territory of Hungary was given away mostly to Slavic peoples, to Romania, to the Czechs, to the Slovenes, to the Serbs. 72% of Hungary was given away at the end of World War I. And we don't hear, you know, that's not discussed very often, even in revisionist circles. Well, Saint-Germain and Trianon and Neville Chamberlain sought to rectify some of the oppressive and tyrannical provisions of those treaties. However, during Roosevelt's second administration, from 1936, right, and especially after Winston Churchill assumed power, 1939, the war drums were beaten louder and louder until ultimately Britain declared war against Germany. After the war, Chamberlain, to his everlasting credit, continued to insist that the provisions of the Munich Pact remained valid and that the boundaries established at the Paris Peace Conference were unjust. He was ignored and the pact annulled.
Now, as far as Churchill putting Britain on a course to war or helping in that, I have a few quotes here. This one is from Emil Ludwig Cohn, 1934 June. "Hitler will have no war. He does not want war, but we will force it on him, not this year, but soon." Here's another one from David Brown, National Chairman of the United Jewish Campaign, 1934. "We Jews are going to bring a war on Germany." Here's Paul Dreyfus, May 15, 1938. "Before the end of the year, an economic bloc of England, Russia, France, and the United States will be formed to bring the German and Italian economic systems to their knees," end quote. And mind you that I think at this point, Italian fascism still accepted Jews, but there weren't that many Jews in it, and then Hitler was starting to clue Mussolini as to what the Jews were all up to, and in a few years he would purge the fascist party of Jews. But the Jews are so hostile to fascism, even when fascism was in Italy at the time was accepting and inclusive of Jews, they recognized fascism as a threat to Jewish power. You know, Italy
absolutely. Fascism is the thinking man's response to Jewish vulture capitalism. There's no doubt. Fascism is free enterprise, which is protected by the state and ensures that the capital within a state operates for the benefit of the people of the state. That's how I would define fascism.
Even Italy hadn't made any sort of move against Jewry because it was anti-communist and anti-capitalist. The Jews saw that as, of course, a move against Jewry.
Because Jewish capital is threatened by any state that wants to defend its own interests. When a state seeks to defend its own interests, its own intellectual property, its own natural resources, that basically precludes Jewish capital from looting and pillaging.
Right.
And the Jews hate that.
Here are a few more. The war now proposed is for the purpose of establishing a Jewish hegemony throughout the world. Brigadier General George Van Horn, New York Tribune, March 29, 1939.
Well, the proof is in the pudding.
In losing Germany, Jewry lost a territory from which it exerted power. Therefore, it was determined to reconquer it. Louis Marshalko.
And that's absolutely true. They controlled Germany during the Weimar Republic.
Absolutely. So I think those quotes establish the Jews are really beating the war drums for a confrontation, a showdown with Germany. And every time the statesmen in the West agreed to something, or every time they sidestepped the issue and just let Hitler work it out with the powers involved instead of interfering, the Jews were outraged. They wanted a war in 1933.
Well, they made sure that FDR stayed in office, and they made sure that Winston Churchill came to office, because Winston Churchill was their war whore. He was the political leader in Britain that was going to bring them the war that they promised. Chamberlain, all we had when Chamberlain was in power was the phony war, right?
Well, Chamberlain wasn't even really in, was he? I mean, Chamberlain was pretty much out very shortly after the confrontation with Poland. Churchill was made First Lord of the Admiralty, I think, 2 or 3 days after the German army moved into Poland, and then he became Prime Minister very shortly after that.
Well, right, but that guaranteed the war. That Churchill's elevation to Prime Minister guaranteed the war. There's no doubt. And that's why he was put there. He was the hawk.
Churchill was put in right before the campaign in France.
Well, with his background on Czechoslovakia, we should probably pick up this Daniel Michaels article next week, because it's insightful, and I'm sure that we can enhance it with other sources. But what we should get on with this speech from September 12, 1938.
Oh, one more thing here, one more quote. Joining with Samuel Untermeyer in calling for a war against Germany, Bernard Baruch declared, quote, "I emphasize that the defeat of Germany and Japan and their elimination from world trade will give Britain a tremendous opportunity to swell her foreign commerce in both volume and profit." So Untermeyer and Bernard Baruch were both agitating for war in the U.S. And you said that Untermeyer, he's the Jew who bought the Schofield translation, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Samuel Untermeyer is the Jew that made American Protestantism safe for Jews.
Hmm.
And now, basically, because of the translation of Schofield and Bullinger to a degree, American Protestants basically, that they're Christians in name only, that they hate Christ and they love the Jews because they love the enemies of Christ. They worship the Jews instead of worshiping Christ.
They might as well be reading the Talmud.
And that was brought to us by Untermeyer, Schofield, and Bullinger. They may as well be reading the Talmud. If you read the Schofield Bible notes and the Bullinger, Numbers and Scripture is right from the Kabbalah, and all of Bullinger's notes are from the Masorah. Why not just have the Jews preach your Christianity to you? Why not just have the Antichrist preach your Christianity to you? You may as well. And that's most American scholarship is modeled after Schofield and Bullinger in our seminaries today. And that's why those books are still on the shelves. That's why those books are still prominent on the shelves and where Bibles are sold. Because those books are the best Christianity that Jewish money can buy. And Samuel Untermeyer brought us the Scofield Bible, and he also brought us World War II, starting in 1933.
And American Protestants just stood back and probably applauded, because he was one of God's chosen people.
Well, they were all for it, exactly, right. Okay, this is Adolf Hitler. This is his closing speech at the National Socialist Party Congress in Nuremberg, September 12, 1938. Today we feel doubly close to those times because, first of all, in our midst, we see the fighters of the eldest German Ostmark, who until recently were subject to a like persecution because of their National Socialist conviction. They stand amongst us today as Volksgenossen, actually that just means hellos, I don't know why the Germans can't shorten that up, and citizens of the German Reich. What have they not had to go through, to suffer through? How many of their comrades were slain? How many injured in body and spirit? How many lost their livelihoods for many years? And how many 10,000s were imprisoned in jails, penitentiaries, and Anhaltlagers? The second reason for which we reflect upon these times with particular emotion is the fact that the events we experienced and suffered in our own nation at the time are precisely those we are witnessing on the world stage today. And above all, our enemies today remain Weltanschaulich, the very same ones. Almost every year we could step before the nation with a quiet confidence and await its judgment. The greatest approval ever granted the leadership of a folk became ours on April 10th of this year. The folk acknowledged and confirmed that it regards the new form of state and its leadership as institutions that strive to the best of their abilities to serve the folk and to lead it once more to freedom and greatness and to ensure its economic well-being. And still, what we are witnessing today on a larger scale is precisely the same we experienced in the decades of internal struggle. Ever since the day we assumed power, we have been surrounded by a hostile environment. As soon as the Nazi party came to power, right? I mean, the Jews declared war on Germany.
You did.
The
Germany, March 24, 1933, British Daily Express, and officially that newspaper doesn't exist. For £50, they'll help you get an archive issue going back 100 years. If you email them about that issue, they won't return your email, or they'll return it and say they can't help you with that issue, but they'll gladly help you with another issue.
Right, that's incredible. You think if that issue was not saying what revisionists say that it claim that it says, that they would have an issue, right? The connivance between the gilded capitalist democratic movement in our parliament on the one hand, with Marxism on the other, and their war on National Socialism is today mirrored in a like conspiracy, albeit on a larger scale, involving the democracies and the Bolshevists, as they make war on a state constituted by the National Socialist Volksgemeinschaft. Volksgemeinschaft. I'm sorry, I'm just going to butcher all this German, right? Perhaps the most persuasive evidence of the insincerity of their fight against the National Socialist Party as it struggled for power at the time is the fact that no matter whether they were bourgeois nationalists, capitalist Democrats, or Marxist internationalists, they formed a unitary front against us in all decisive battles. That there's no difference between capitalist Democrats and Marxist internationalists in reality, is there? At the time, many of our Volksgenossen were forced to realize just how dishonest the political battle was and of how little import morals were in this fight as they saw those parties fighting us on nationalist grounds, yet were not reluctant to conspire with Marxist internationalists to that end. And vice versa, our Volksgenossen had to realize just how dishonest and fraudulent those parties were who claimed to persecute us for socialist reasons and then went to ally themselves with the worst proponents of capitalism prior to entering the unitary front against us. The center party claimed to be fighting us because we were hostile to the church, which was never true, and yet to this end it entered into a holy alliance with atheist social democrats and did not shrink from uniting with the communists. And on the other hand, communists fought us because, as they claimed, we represented the reaction in their eyes. Yet they cast their ballot together with the true reactionaries against the vote of the National Socialist Party and the Reichstag. What Hitler, I think, is saying is that the same Jews control all these parties, is he not?
Absolutely.
It was indeed a display of such...
invention, isn't it, Bill? Social democracy is a Jewish invention.
Absolutely.
To make communism acceptable by people who would not accept overt communism.
It was indeed a display of such duplicity that one could only turn from it in disgust. Today we feel equally repelled as we watch the so-called international world democracies who supposedly advocate liberty, fraternity, justice, the right to self-determination of the peoples, etc., as we see these states ally themselves with Bolshevist Moscow. One day, perhaps, someone will ask why we concern ourselves so much with the democracies and why we treat them in so negative a manner. Well, they're controlled by Jews. This is the case first. First, as those attacked, we are forced to counter. Second, the conduct of these phenomena is so revolting. Dishonesty sets in the minute these democracies claim to represent government by the people and decry authoritarian states as dictatorships. I believe that I can confidently state that today there are only two world powers who can honestly claim to have 99% of their people backing the government. What in other countries goes by the name of democracy is in most cases little other than the apt manipulation of public opinion by means of money and the press, and how true that is, and the equally apt manipulation of the results hereby achieved. How easily, however, are these supposed democracies stripped bare of their pretenses? When one takes a close look at their stance in matters of foreign policy, which constantly change to suit the purpose of the moment. There we witness how truly repressive regimes in small countries are actually being glorified by these democracies if it suits their needs. We've seen this all throughout our own history, right? Yes, even they even go so far as to fight for them, while on the other hand, they themselves actively repress inconvenient rallies in those states where such protest does not suit them. They fail to acknowledge this activism, attempt to subvert it, or simply misinterpret its significance. And this is not all. These democracies even glorify Bolshevist regimes, which the United States did, if it happens to suit their purpose, and this in spite of the fact that the later style themselves as the dictatorship of the proletariat. The hypocrisy of the West is incredible, and Hitler understood it.
The Bolshevists even used the term dictatorship.
In other words, these supposed democracies decry regimes that are backed by 99% of their constituents as dictatorships, while at the same time they praise other countries as highly respectable democratic institutions, even though these call themselves dictatorships, and even though they can only subsist on the basis of mass executions, torture, etc. Is it not one of the greatest ironies in history that in the midst of upright prototype Democrats in Geneva, the blood-drenched proponent of one of the cruelest tyrannies of all time moves about freely as a highly respected member of the council? We in Germany have already witnessed the alliance of Jewish capitalism with an abstract version of communist anti-capitalism, and we have seen the Rotfahn, the Vorwärts, and the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung march hand in hand here, the Jewish press, right? It is the same all over the world. Bolshevist Moscow has become the highly revered ally of the capitalist democracies. For 15 years, they have acted in gruesome defiance of the most natural interests of their peoples. Yes, acting contrary to any standards of human dignity. Indeed, they drew up diktats with a pistol in hand, only to, at a later date, lament the unilateral transgression of holy rites and the breach of all the more holy contracts. Without so much as a thought for the opinion of the natives, they have led a drive for the bloody subjugation of entire continents. However, the minute that Germany mentions the return of its colonies, they declared that out of concern for the indigenous people there, one could not possibly abandon the natives to so horrid a fate. At the same time, they did not distance themselves from dropping bombs out of their planes onto their own colonies. And all this, to use the force of reason to persuade the dear colored compatriots to submit to the foreign rule a bit longer. Of course, the bombs thus employed were bombs with civilizing warheads, which one must absolutely not confuse with those brutal ones that Italy used in Abyssinia. Throughout the democratic countries, one laments the unimaginable cruelty with which first Germany, and now Italy as well, are striving to rid themselves of the Jewish element.
You know, the first country to pioneer using an aircraft to attack a ship, it was the Netherlands in the Dutch East Indies. There was a ship that was it fell to a mutiny. The colored crew basically seized the ship, and some of the white Marxists on the ship sided with the colored crew. So they sent in a bomber. I think it was a dive bomber. They dropped a few bombs on the ship to crush the mutiny. So I'm sure that the British would allow that for, you know, those Dutch, they nipped that mutiny in the bud. But if the Italians drop a bomb or two in Ethiopia, it's an atrocity.
Well, basically, that's what Hitler's describing. Throughout the democratic countries, one laments the unimaginable cruelty with which first Germany and now Italy as well are striving to rid themselves of the Jewish element. However, all these great democratic empires have altogether little more than a few persons per square kilometer. In Italy and in Germany, this number exceeds 140 persons. For decades, Germany nevertheless took in hundreds of thousands upon hundreds of thousands of Jews without batting an eyelid. Now that the burden has become overbearing and the nation is no longer willing to have its lifeblood sucked out of it by these parasites, it is now that there is a great lament abroad. However, not a word is heard in these democratic countries about replacing this hypocritical lamentation with a good deed and assistance. No, to the contrary, all one hears is cold reasoning, claiming that in these states there is regretfully no space either. Evidently, they expect us to bear up under this burden of Jewry, despite our 140 persons per square kilometer. While the democratic world empires, with their few people per square kilometer, could not possibly shoulder this burden, alas, no help but morals. And thus we find the National Socialist Reich faced with the same phenomenon that forces that we had 15 years to get to know as a party. But what's funny is that today, the same Europe, which is very crowded, the Netherlands is one of the most crowded nations in the world, right? People per square kilometer. And not only Holland, but Denmark and France and Britain are all being, that they're all small countries and are all being flooded with Muslims when there's plenty of other places to go with much more room and much sparser populations, right?
The population density in Germany is now twice what it was at the time Hitler was speaking.
And there's still large amounts of Turks immigrating into Germany.
Absolutely, and I wonder what the population density in Turkey happens to be. In fact,
I wonder how many Turks there are immigrating into China, where 1.5 billion yellow people live, where they have plenty of land and no multiculturalism.
Oh, the population density in Turkey is 1/3 that of Germany. And in China, let's see, the population density is about half that of Germany.
Well, I think all the Negroes and Arabs should go to China. We need multiculturalism in China.
None of them should go to Israel. I think Israel could accommodate some. Or how about the Sudan? The Sudan has about 20 kafirs per square kilometer.
Well, the bottom line is that it's the evident destruction of the white race. It's only white nations that have to be flooded with all these brown people. Nobody's talking about sending brown people to China, where nothing but yellow people live. Only yellow people live in China. China needs to be multiculturalized. I think all the Jews should move to China and bring the brown people with them. Insofar as this is indicative of the hostile attitude of the democratic states toward Germany, this matters little to us. Besides, why should we fare any better than the Reich before us? On a side note, I will admit quite openly that I find it easier to bear insults from someone who can no longer rob me than to be robbed by someone who praises me for letting it happen. And that's the nationalist dilemma in the United States today. Today and in Europe.
Most people would rather be insulted.
Yeah, yes. Most people would rather be robbed by someone who praises them for letting it happen.
Yes, that's
and,
right.
And that's what multiculturalism and diversity are. White people in their own nations are being stripped bare, and the Jews praise them because they're so tolerant and they've accepted diversity.
So basically what's happening, these people have the praise of the Jews, and the Jews say what great Christians they are, but they're not actually practicing true Christianity. They're being robbed blind, and the Jews are thanking them for it.
Absolutely. This comportment becomes unbearable for us. I'm sorry. For this, admittedly, it received compensation, the somewhat sparse recompense, at least in my eyes, of praise for having been a good little democratic state. That's Germany in the Weimar years, right? This comportment becomes unbearable for us the minute a major part of our folk is placed at the mercy of impertinent abusers, ostensibly without any means of defending itself, while the brunt of democratic rhetoric pours forth as a threat to our Volksgenossen. I am speaking of the Czechoslovakia. This state is a democracy. That is to say, it was founded on democratic principles. The majority of its people was simply forced to submit to the structure construed at Versailles without anyone asking for its opinion. As the true democracy, this state immediately began to suppress the majority of its people, to abuse them and to rob them of their inalienable rights. Gradually, one attempted to impress upon the world that this state had a special military and political mission to fulfill. The former French Minister of Aviation, Pierre Cot, has explained this to us recently. According to him, and this is what you were saying before, Czechoslovakia exists for the purpose of providing a base. In the event of war, for launching aerial attacks and dropping bombs upon German cities and industrial plants. Needless to say, we may assume that these will once again be equipped with those warheads of the famed civilizing variety. In other words, French and English and American warheads are considered by the Western democracies as civilizing warheads. But German and Italian warheads are barbaric, right? However, this mission stands in opposition to the desires of the majority of the inhabitants of this state and is alien to their philosophy of life and contrary to their vital interests. That is why the majority of its citizens were silenced. Any protest against this fate would have been an assault upon the aims incarnate in this state and hence would have been in violation of its constitution. Drawn up by the Democrats, this constitution was less suited to realizing the rights of the people affected and was instead more tailored toward accommodating the political expediencies of the people's oppressors. Political expediency necessitated as well that a structure be construed that accorded the Czech people a position of preeminence in this state. Whoever protested against this usurpation became an enemy of the state, and hence, in accordance with democratic norms, he was outlawed. Providence has thus called upon the so-called people of the Czech state, admittedly voicing its intent through the good offices of the architects of Versailles, to stand guard lest someone rise in opposition to this ultimate purpose of the state. Should someone nevertheless venture to step forth from amongst the majority of the oppressed peoples in this state, who were all the non-Czech people, as we saw in the words of Daniel Michaels.
The Slovaks certainly weren't happy with Czechoslovakia. In fact, as soon as they had the chance, they rallied around Tiso in Bratislava, and they worked with Hitler throughout the war.
Right. Well, the Slovaks were more conservative, and the Bohemians were very liberal urban people, and the Slovaks, actually Hitler was received very well in Czechoslovakia when he, and there are many pictures that prove that. Well, when he visited there after the German takeover of Czechoslovakia. What we've seen, what Hitler's saying about the oppression of the non-Czech people in Czechoslovakia was echoed by Viscount Walter Runciman, who was a confidant of Prime Minister Chamberlain, in his report to Chamberlain in 1938, as Dan Michaels quoted in the article that I cited earlier. So Hitler's that these speeches are all be corroborated by the political records of the Western democracies, right? I mean, Hitler's not making this up. Should someone nevertheless venture to step forth from amongst the majority of the oppressed peoples in this state, meaning Czechoslovakia, and voice opposition to this end, then it is naturally permissible that he be beaten back with the full force at the state's disposal, and if so desire or need be, he could also simply be murdered. Now let me say, I looked for a 1919 census of Czechoslovakia, and I really couldn't find one. I looked online today in looking for material for this program tonight, and currently there are about 10.5 million residents of the Czech Republic, and there are about 5.5 million residents of the Slovakia, right? And the Slovak, the Slovak portion of the former state of Czechoslovakia, right? Well, that's 16 million people today. Now, in 1938, there were 3.5 million Germans inside of the Czech borders. And I'm sure that the population probably was not 16 million people. So there are, it is a, the Germans alone are one minority in the Czech lands that Hitler's talking about. The Slovaks are another. Now, today, the Slovaks are a third of the population. And even if we had the same population in 1938, 16 million people, we would have 5 million Slovaks and 3.5 million Germans. Right. I mean, they were definitely the minority factions in Czechoslovakia were a significant portion of the population. They had to be. And that's the point I'm trying to make. I looked for the numbers from 1919 to 1938, and I didn't see any specific numbers. I may have missed them, but I did look and didn't see anything. If this now did not concern us, if this was some foreign affair, we, like so many others, might take note of it or simply as a most interesting display of the Democrats' understanding of the rights of peoples to self-determination. That's a direct stab at the Western democracies for being hypocrites and the United States for double-crossing and not enforcing the 14 points of Woodrow Wilson, right?
14 points. However, a bunch of platitudes designed to get the German army to leave the field in 1918.
Well, exactly. But if the United States had any honor, it should make sure that the word that it gave was followed, right? I mean, that's only right. And it shows that we were a double-crossing, duplicitous nation in the Woodrow Wilson era, 100 years ago, led around by the testicles by the international Jew at that time. Emasculated by the international Jew at that time. However, the nature of the affair involves an obligation of us Germans. In other words, Hitler can't stand around while 3.5 million Germans in the Sudetenland, which was formerly German territory, were just abused by this alien government. That wouldn't be right. Amongst the suppressed minorities in the state, there were also 3.5 million Germans, roughly as many people of our race as Denmark has in inhabitants. These Germans are God's creatures as well. The Almighty has not, now Hitler was a Christian, right? He's not just being patronizing here. The Almighty has not created them so that the construction arrived at in Versailles might place them at the mercy of an alien power that they hate. And he has not created 7 million Czechs either. So now we have some understanding of the population, how many Czechs there were. And he has not created 7 million Czechs either so that they may reign over these 3.5 million, keep them in tutelage, and even far less did he create them to ravage and torture.
Now, the British, for all their pretense of Christianity, Hitler's pointed out that everywhere that Chamberlain goes, he has a Bible under his arm. For all their pretense of Christianity, it seems when Germans are suffering or when Italians are suffering or when, you know, Christian fascist people are suffering somewhere, they close their hearts to the cries and the pleas for help.
Well, the English were the most bellicose nation in the history of Europe for hundreds of years, right? That they made war and abused everybody. I'm sure it was all at the instigation of the Jewish bankers of the city. And that would be, you know, Nuss, Empire of the City is a book that would bring one to that understanding. I think his initials are E.R., E.R. Nuss. I read that a long time ago. I have it here somewhere. I'll try to locate it one day.
All right. Would you like for me to
Well, the English oppressed the Irish. They created all kinds of propaganda in London that was anti-Irish propaganda. They did the same thing to the Scots. They did the same thing to the Germans. And that just justified English bellicosity against all her neighbors.
I can't think of a country England hasn't attacked at least once. They've even sold out their own kind, their own colonial settlers in Rhodesia.
Yes, they did.
In Kenya, Nigeria, all across Africa, they sold their own people out.
Well, the revolution here was because they would have sold their own people out here.
Absolutely.
That they oppressed their own people everywhere.
You like me that over the reason?
The beckoning of the Jewish bankers in the city. The real crown, right? The situation in the state has become unbearable, as is well known. In a political context, 3.5 million people there are robbed of their right to self-determination in the name of the right to self-determination as construed by a certain Mr. Wilson. In an economic context, these people are being ruined methodically and are hence subject to a slow but steady extermination. The misery of the Sudeten Germans defies description. One desires to destroy them. In a humanitarian context, they are being oppressed and humiliated in an unprecedented fashion. When 3.5 million members of a folk of 80 million may not sing a song they like because the Czechs dislike it, when they are beaten until they bleed simply because they wear stockings, which the Czechs care not to see, when I guess he's talking about lederhosen, right? I don't know. Well, when they are terrorized and abused because they greet one another in a fashion which the Czechs cannot bear, even though they were merely greeting one another and no Czech, and when they are persecuted because of every little detail connected to the expression of their nationality, and when they are hunted down as though animals, yes, then this may leave those renowned representatives of democracy cold. Who knows? They might actually enjoy it since those affected are a mere 3.5 million Germans. All I can say to these representatives of democracy is that this does not leave us cold. No, if these tortured creatures can find neither justice nor help by themselves, then they will receive both from us. There must be an end to the injustice inflicted upon these people. I have already stated this quite openly in my speech of February 20th. It was a short-sighted enterprise which the architects of Versailles conceived when they gave birth to the abnormal structure of the Czechoslovakian state. It could pursue its mission to ravage and rape a mass of millions of other nationalities only as long as the brother nations themselves suffered from the abuse inflicted upon the world at Versailles. However, to believe that such a regime could continue to sin eternally and endlessly means to succumb to an inconceivable delusion. In my speech before the German Reichstag on February 20th, I had pointed out that the Reich will no longer stand for any further oppression and persecution of these 3.5 million Germans, and I implore all foreign statesmen not to think this mere rhetoric. For the sake of peace in Europe, the National Socialist State has made enormous sacrifices for the entire nation. It did not harbor any thoughts of so-called revenge. Rather, it has banished all such thoughts from all private and public spheres of life. In the course of the 17th century, France slowly penetrated Alsace-Lorraine and took it from the old German Reich in the midst of peacetime. Following a dreadful war in 1870 and 71, which had been forced upon Germany, the Reich reclaimed these territories and they were returned to it. They were lost once more after the World War, World War I. To us Germans, the cathedral in Strasbourg means a lot. And when we did not pursue the matter any further, we refrained only in the service of a lasting peace for Europe. No one could have forced us to cede these claims voluntarily had we not wished to give them up in the first place. Let me state that Hitler professed that Germany would not seek the return of Alsace-Lorraine under his leadership. We gave them up because we willed an end to this constant argument with France once and for all. That should have satisfied French fears towards Germany when Hitler made that token of clemency and mercy, right? I mean, that's the way I see it. The Reich has espoused a similar stance and has taken similarly determined steps along its other borders as well. Here, National Socialism acted highly responsibly and set an example. We made the greatest of sacrifices and distanced ourselves voluntarily from any further demands so that Europe might enjoy a peaceful future and so that a passage might be cleared, at least on our part, for reconciliation of all peoples worldwide. We acted in an exceedingly loyal fashion. And it must be said that Hitler's policy towards Alsace-Lorraine is proof that Adolf Hitler did not want war, that he sought peace. Neither press, silver screen, nor stage were allowed to propagate a diverging opinion. In other words, the Jewish media was shut down. Not even in literature did we allow for an exception. In a related spirit, I offered solutions for a reduction of tensions in Europe, an offer that was refused for reasons we still fail to comprehend. Well, it was refused because the Jews wanted war.
Absolutely, and if the Jews tell the leaders in the West you're going to refuse these proposals, those proposals are refused, although in the case of France was overtly, run by an out-and-out Jew, Leon Blum. So some of those countries didn't even have to have Jewish advisors like Baruch and Frankfurter say, no, don't accept this. They just had the Jews already at the helm.
Right. Germany, we voluntarily restricted our power in this important realm in the hope that we should never again be forced to use arms against this one other state in question. This did not happen because we would not have been able to produce 55% more ships. It occurred because we wished to contribute to a final reduction of tensions and to a pacification of the situation in Europe. Since we found a great patriot and statesman in Poland willing to enter into an agreement with Germany, we immediately seized the opportunity and arrived at a treaty that no doubt is of far greater import to peace in Europe than all the talk in the halls of the League of Nations Temple in Geneva. It's a shame he didn't live longer. Germany today possesses many a completely pacified border, and Germany is determined and has stated as much to accept these borders as inviolable and unchangeable in order to give Europe a feeling of security and peace. Apparently, however, this self-denial and self-discipline on the part of Germany has been misinterpreted as a sign of weakness. Kindness is often taken as weakness when the denizens of the stage live by the law of the jungle. Hence, today I would like to set things right. I do not believe we would be rendering peace in Europe a great service if we pronounced our disinterest in all European affairs. In particular, Germany would not be doing anyone a great service if it remained unmoved by the suffering and plight of 3.5 million Volksgenossen, and if it did not take an interest in their fate. We understand when England and France pursue their interests in the world. I wish to point out to the statesmen in Paris and London that there are German interests as well, and that we are determined to pursue these under all circumstances. At this point, I would like to remind them of my speech before the Reichstag in 1933, in which I openly avowed before all the world that there were questions of national concern in which our path was clearly predetermined. I would rather submit myself to any ordeal, danger, or torment than to fail in the fulfillment of such prerogatives. No European state has done as much as Germany in the service of peace. No one has made greater sacrifices. One must bear in mind, however, that there is a limit to how much one can sacrifice, and one should not confuse National Socialist Germany with the Germany of Bethmann, Hallweg, and Herding. When I make this declaration, I do so because of an event that occurred in the course of this year, an event that forces all of us to reconsider our stance today. As you well know, my party comrades, Czechoslovakia has finally announced local elections to be held this year after infinitely postponing any form of plebiscite. Even Prague has finally admitted to the untenable nature of its present position. It fears the unity of the Germans and of the other nationalities. It is convinced that it has to resort to extraordinary measures in order to exert pressure in the election process and thus to manipulate the outcome of the election. Evidently, the Czechoslovakian government has concluded that this can be achieved only through a brutal policy of intimidation. Apparently, the Czech state has felt the display of its military might was particularly well suited to this end.
What
this was especially.
Body?
I'm sorry.
What military might? Isn't that kind of like a mouse trying to scare an elephant?
Well, that he's talking about the situation of the Sudeten Germans, right?
This was especially geared toward. Bill, is it too much of an exaggeration to say that it seems like the Czechs are almost as bellicose as the Poles, but not quite as brutal?
Yeah, they as an international power, they had none. But he's talking about the position of the Czechs towards the minorities in the minority nations in Czechoslovakia, where the Czechs were the dominant force, right? And they had all of the assets of the government at their hands. This was especially geared towards the Sudeten Germans, to serve as a warning not to speak up for their national interests and to vote accordingly. In order to somehow justify this attempt at intimidation before the eyes of the world public, the Czech government, i.e. Herr Benetz, fabricated the lie that German troops had been mobilized for an invasion of Czechoslovakia.
Believe me, if that man honestly believed German troops had been mobilized, he would have been on the first plane for Romania, Poland, or France. He wouldn't have been hanging around announcing it.
In this context, let me today state the following. The creation of such lies is nothing new. About a year ago, the press in a certain country invented a story according to which 20,000 German soldiers had landed in Morocco. The Jewish proponent of this lie in the press hoped to thereby cause a war. At the time, it had sufficed to address a short statement to the French ambassador to resolve the situation. And in this instance as well, we immediately assured the ambassador of another great power of the falsehood of the Czech allegations.
All right, so we've talked in the first part about France and in the second part, Britain.
Right. The statement was issued once more, and the Prague government was immediately informed of its content. Nevertheless, the government in Prague exploited this deception as a pretext for its terrorist blackmail and manipulation of the election. All that I can do in retrospect is to assert that, for one, not one German soldier has been called up other than those serving anyway at this point in time. Secondly, not one regiment Not one additional unit had marched to the border. Indeed, not one soldier serving in a garrison other than the one assigned to him for peacetime during this period. To the contrary, orders were issued to avoid taking any steps that might be construed as a means for exerting pressure on Czechoslovakia on our part. Nonetheless, a base and vile campaign against us was launched in which all of Europe was organized in the service of the government in pursuit of criminal goals. This government's sole ambition lay in a manipulation of the election by the exertion of military pressure in an effort to intimidate its citizens and thus rob them of their right to vote. And all this was merely a means of obtaining moral legitimacy, which this government felt it needed. Indeed, it had no scruples to cast suspicion on one great state, to alarm all of Europe, and to, if need be, plunge Europe into a bloody war. The Reich government undertook no such steps, and in fact, Germany had no such intention. Quite to the contrary, it was convinced that the local elections would do justice to the Sudeten German cause. This lack of activity was then construed as a sign that the German government stepped down because of the determined stance of the Czechs and of the early intervention by England and France. You will understand, my party comrades, that a great power cannot tolerate such a base incursion, the partial mobilization of Czech troops on May 20th and 21st of this year, a second time. As a consequence, I have taken the necessary precautions. I am a National Socialist, and as such, I am accustomed to strike back at any attacker. Moreover, I know only too well that leniency will not succeed in appeasing, but will merely encourage the arrogance of so irreconcilable an adversary as the Czechs.
Well, they would mistake his compassion and his willingness for peace as weakness. That's how they would interpret it.
Well, absolutely.
They would seek further concessions, and they would seek to exploit what they saw as a weakness.
Let the fate of the old German Reich be a warning to us. Its love for peace drove it to the brink of self-destruction. Nonetheless, the old Reich could not prevent the war in the end. In due consideration thereof, I took steps on May 28th, which were very difficult. First, I ordered a far-reaching intensification and the immediate implementation and execution of the reinforcements announced for Army and Luftwaffe. Second, I ordered the immediate expansion of our fortifications to the west. I can assure you that ever since May 28th, the construction of one of the most gigantic fortresses of all time has been underway there. To this end, I entrusted Dr. Tott, the German General Inspector for Road Construction in Germany, with a new commission. Within the framework of the projects undertaken by the Fortress Construction Inspectorate, he has achieved one of the greatest accomplishments of all time, thanks to his extraordinary organizational talent.
If Germany were planning an offensive, they wouldn't be putting all of these resources into the Siegfried Line on their western border. Since you don't fortify your border if you're intending to launch an offensive, you would devote all those resources to offensive weaponry.
Well, right. If you don't fortify your rear guard when your whole nation is behind you.
Absolutely.
Right. The Siegfried Line is all the proof in the world that Hitler did not plan an offensive against
Western. Or else he would have poured all of those resources into vehicles, artillery, munitions, instead of building defensive fortifications to repel an attack.
Well, Stalin wasn't building defensive fortifications in the east of Germany, was he? Stalin wasn't building defensive fortifications to protect Russia from Germany, was he?
Well, he built the Stalin Line, but that began in the 1920s, continued in the 1930s, and they abandoned a large part of it to begin the new Molotov Line further west. They wanted to build a line of fortifications right on the border with Germany, but it's also clear from where their air bases were positioned, they were only intending to use this line as basically a screen from which, you know, behind which they would launch an attack upon Central Europe, since all of their air bases were deployed forward instead of in the back.
Right. Let me point out a few figures to you. At present, at work on the fortification of our western frontier, a project actually begun over 2 years ago are 278,000 laborers in the TOT organization, in addition to 84,000 other laborers. In addition to 100,000 men of the Reich Labor Service and numerous pioneer battalions and infantry divisions, besides the materials that are brought to the construction sites via different transportation routes, the German Reichsbahn alone transports 8,000 freight cars a day. The daily consumption of gravel amounts to over 100,000 tons. The fortification of Germany's western border will be completed prior to the onset of winter. Its defensive capacity is already assured as of this day. Once completed, it will consist of over 17,000 armored plates and concrete structures. The German folk in arms stands behind his front of steel and concrete, made up of three fortified lines, and in some locations actually consists of four fortified lines up to 50 kilometers deep. I have made this greatest effort of all time in the service of peace. Under no circumstances, however, am I willing to quietly stand by and observe from afar the continued oppression of German Volksgenossen in Czechoslovakia. It's all tactics. Herr Benez talks, wants to organize negotiations. He wishes to resolve the question of procedure in accordance with the Geneva Convention and hands out little favors to placate the people. Things cannot go this way. This is not a question of empty diplomatic phrases. This is a question of right, the question of a right not granted. What we Germans demand is the right to self-determination, a right every folk possesses and not an empty phrase. Herr Benez is not supposed to grant the Sudeten Germans any favors. They have a right to their own way of life, just as any other people do. The consequences will be grave ones should, perchance, the democracies persist in their conviction that they must continue to, by any and all means, accord their protection to the oppression of German men and women. I believe it to be in the service of peace if I leave no doubts as to this fact. I am asking neither that Germany be allowed to oppress 3.5 million Frenchmen, nor am I asking that 3.5 million Englishmen be placed at our mercy. Rather, I am simply demanding that the oppression of 3.5 million Germans in Czechoslovakia cease and that the inalienable right to self-determination take its place. We would truly regret if this were to cloud or damage our relations to the other European states. Yet the fault would not be ours. It is the business of the Czechoslovakian government to come to terms with the true representatives of the Sudeten Germans and, in one way or another, to reach some form of understanding with them. Nevertheless, it is my business and my Volksgenossen. It is the business of all of us to take care that justice not be perverted into injustice. After all, this matter involves our German Volksgenossen, or fellows. I am not in the least willing to allow foreign statesmen to create a second Palestine right here in the heart of Germany. The poor Arabs are defenseless and have been abandoned by all. The Germans in Czechoslovakia are neither defenseless nor have they been abandoned. Please note this fact. Isn't it amazing that Adolf Hitler has the same position that American liberals do on Palestine?
It would seem interesting, wouldn't it? Certainly. And Hitler's probably the only one who's ever been sincerely in favor of independence for Palestine. He was so sincere. In fact, I believe the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem supported Hitler and called for a jihad against the British, if I'm not mistaken. Do you know anything about that, sir?
No, I don't know enough about the politics in Palestine in the 1930s and 40s. I do understand that there were a lot of Jewish terrorist gangs like the Irgun and things like that that were acting against the British to get them out so that they could have what their way with the Arabs, right?
Yes. Well, I believe, I forget the Grand Mufti's name, but he actually helped oversee the formation of several divisions of Muslims, Albanian Muslims and Bosnian Muslims. And I think the Bosnian Muslims did pretty well, but the Albanians were, the Germans regarded them as shiftless, lazy. Most of them, as soon as they were issued a rifle and boots, they just ran off back into the hills with all of their newly issued equipment. And they didn't really fight that well. But the Bosnian Muslims were pretty crazy from everything I've read about them. They were ferocious. But that's probably just a reflection on the fact that Bosnian Muslims are probably racially Serbo-Croatian, mostly Croats, and of course the Albanian Muslims, they're all just Turks in Albania. Where in Bosnia, they're just white people who, for whatever reason, are practicing Islam.
Well, it's I think that it's quite ironic that Adolf Hitler had the same position on the Arabs in Palestine that those people that Anders Breivik shot up had in Norway. That's pretty funny. I think it's ironic. I am compelled to broach this topic at that party congress in which the representatives of our German, Austrian Gauss participate for the first time. Better than anyone else, they know how painful it is to be separated from the mother country. Easier than anyone else, they will grasp the full import of my exposition on this day. With greater enthusiasm than any, they will agree with me when I state before the entire folk that we would not deserve to be Germans if we were not willing to take such a stance and to bear up under the consequences one way or another. When we bear in mind the intolerable impertinence with which even a small state dared to approach Germany in the last months, then we realize that the only explanation possible is revealed in the unwillingness to recognize the German Reich is more than just a peace-loving upstart state. Standing in Rome in the springtime, I felt deep inside that we assess historic developments in a far too restricted a manner, investigating time periods far too short to be revealing. Isn't that the truth? 1,000 or 1,500 years are no more than a few dynastic successions. What exhausts itself in a certain period can rise again in the same time period. Today's Italy and today's Germany are living proof of this. Both are nations that have regenerated, indeed, that might be regarded as new nations in this context. However, their roots spring not from the grounds of more recent ages, but rather they reach back into ancient history. The Roman Empire breathes once more. The phenomenon of Germany as a state is not new either, although it has made its appearance more recently. I think Hitler was giving Mussolini far too much credit there, right? I had the insignias of the old German Reich brought to Nuremberg for a reason. I wish to call to mind, and this is not only for the benefit of the German people, but also for that of all peoples, that more than half a millennium prior to the discovery of the New World, a gigantic German Reich stood on these grounds. He's talking about the time of Otto I, right? The Holy Roman Empire. Dynasties came into being and dissipated. Outward forms changed. Yet while the folk has been rejuvenated, its essence has remained the same as it always has been. The German Reich has been long dormant. Now the German folk has awakened and once more bears its crown of 1,000 years high on its head. All of us who bear witness to this historic resurrection feel great pride and happiness. We stand before the Almighty in humble gratitude. For the rest of the world, this should be an inspiration as well as a lesson learned, an inspiration to reflect upon history from a more elevated point of view, and a lesson not to succumb to the same mistakes as in the past. And in truth, the new Roman-Italian Empire and the Germanic German Reich are ancient structures. You need not love them, and yet no power on earth shall ever again remove them. Party comrades, National Socialists, the First Reich Party Congress of Greater Germany ends at this hour. All of you are still under the spell of the great historic events of these past days. This demonstration of our folk's power and determination has reinforced the nation's pride and your confidence in it. Return to your homes now and carry in your hearts that same faith which you have cherished throughout almost two decades as Germans and as National Socialists. You now have the right to proudly carry your heads high again as Germans. It is the duty of all of us never again to bow our heads to any alien will. To this let us pledge ourselves, so help us God.
When he's saying it, it's not just a platitude or a meaningless utterance. He's actually meaning that. It's not just some...
Well, right. Absolutely. There's no doubt.
American politicians and British politicians, they always they have all these pretenses of "So help me God" or "God bless America." They end every speech with "God bless America," yet he's not going to bless a monstrously sinful, wicked nation. They never tell people to be worthy of God's blessing. They just say "God bless America" as though it should automatically happen. Take it at face value. But, you know, Hitler's clearly somebody who has a very thorough understanding of Scripture, and his faith is very deep and meaningful to him.
No doubt. There is absolutely no doubt.
He's not some wishy-washy Easter Christmas Christian who you see twice a year and he never reads his Bible.
No, his national and all of his political philosophies are based in and grounded in the Bible and in Christian precepts. This depends exclusively on the power of our own weapons, and therefore depends upon the carriers of those weapons themselves. No negotiations, no conferences, and no other agreement has accorded us Germans the natural right to unity. We had to take justice into our own hands, and we were able to do so thanks to your existence, my soldiers. And it is thus that the two greatest institutions in our folk must fulfill two identical missions. National Socialism has to educate our folk within to form this folk's Geheimschaft. The Wehrmacht has to instruct this same folk to defend this folk's Geheimschaft outwardly. So it is you, my soldiers, who were immediately charged with the fulfillment of a mission in this new Reich, and this fulfillment has earned you the love of the German folk. It relied upon you, and it has realized that it can rely upon its sons in uniform. For you carry the best weapons available today, you receive the best training, and I know that you possess the best of character. You will fit in well with the eternal, everlasting front constituted by Germany's soldiers. In the past months, I repeatedly had the opportunity to convince myself of this. I saw it at the maneuver sites, shooting stands, and training camps, and it was with great contentment that I realized that the German nation can once more look to its soldiers with great pride. And it is that for which I thank you. Yes, we do not serve for the sake of gratitude, praise, or recompense, unless this gratitude, praise, and recompense is at the service of what we value the most in this world, our folk and our German Reich, Deutschland, Sieg Heil.
All right.
Okay, good. That's the conclusion.
Closing thoughts on that. I think we've established that Hitler did not want a war with Czechoslovakia, but he recognized Czechoslovakia was an abnormal state that really just should not have existed in the incarnation in which it did exist. And the fact that the communists had to hold it together at gunpoint, and as of the fall of the Eastern Bloc, it's become the Czech Republic and Slovakia. Even the Czechs and Slovaks realized that Czechoslovakia should not have existed as it existed in 1938. Hitler knew that, the Czechs knew that, the Slovaks knew that, but the Czechs didn't seem to mind back then because they were calling the shots.
Right, and Hitler split them along their ancient lines and formed a protectorate for the Czech people.
And the Slovaks didn't seem to mind that much. I mean, some of the Czechs worked with the British, and they supported British resistance, you know, or I should say British contrived Czechoslovak resistance movements, which were really British Secret Service working with agitators mostly Prague. But the Slovaks actually supported the Germans, and they were pretty eager to work with the Germans under Josef Tiso, who was, I believe, a bishop or a priest.
And the proof for how much the British cared about the Czechs in reality, it is seen when Czechoslovakia was handed over to the Bolsheviks, right?
Absolutely.
It was handed over to the Soviets.
Just like Poland.
Yes, just like Poland.
So the British say, oh, we have to defend Czechoslovakia, we have to defend Poland, and how do we defend them? By handing them over to Stalin, old Uncle Joe.
And just like East Germany, Western troops were held back so that the Soviets could march into those areas.
And you know, when the Cossacks were surrendering, the British gave their word. One of them said, I give you my word as a British officer that you'll be held in Britain and then, you know, sent to North America. You will not be returned to the Soviet Union. So the Cossacks all surrendered. They laid down their arms and they said, well, we can trust the British. They should have asked the Boers and the Irish, can we trust the British? Or they should have just looked in their history book and decided, well, when a British officer gives you his word, it's not worth the paper it's written on. Since, as we know, the Cossacks were all handed back over to Stalin.
Absolutely.
In fact, some of them weren't even born in the Soviet Union. They were born to white army emigre parents who fled the Bolshevik Revolution. They were born in, 1918, 1919, 1920 Germany. They fought in Cossack cavalry units because they spoke fluent Russian or fluent Ukrainian in addition to German, so the Germans used them as translators, and they were sent to Stalin. They were sent into the Soviet Union, but they'd never been there except for the war.
Well, we were told we were fighting for freedom, and we handed half the world over to absolute tyranny, right?
So
who was lying?
I remember a World War II propaganda film, Why We Fight. They claim that in Germany, Hitler is shutting down the churches, and during Kristallnacht, they burn down synagogues and churches, and they show Nazis throwing bricks through windows, and did they say that they must, Christ must go, they must make way for the new God, there can only be one God in Germany, and then they show a portrait of Hitler, and they say that people must go to church and pray to Hitler, and they're blaring the song Onward Christian Soldiers, and talking about how in America you're free to worship whoever you want, wherever you want, as often as you want, and so we're fighting a war for freedom of worship, and freedom in general, and at the end of this war we hand over half of the world to Satan. It seems rather ironic.
When a Jew moves his lips, he's lying. And we should stop watching the Jewish media because they're lying to us. That's all they do is lie to us.
Well,
they can't tell us the truth.
They've been lying.
They don't have the truth in them.
They've been lying since Genesis, and they'll be lying right up until Revelation.
Well, absolutely.
All right. Then.
Okay, that's enough for me. And we'll be back next week, I guess, with Eduard Benes and more about Czechoslovakia.
And maybe I'll pull some stuff out about the Versailles Peace Conference from some books I have.
Wonderful.
Right,
appreciate it.